into 1,000 colours, not one of them the sky. And then, in a rush of sound, my sight returns, and with it sensation. The girl's hand pulling my head above water and the sting of ocean in my nostrils. The white capel is nothing but his mane floating in the water, the surf kicking his corpse toward the beach. The dun pony stands on the sand and whinnies to the girl, a high, anxious sound. There's blood in the water, and blood there on the sand, too, where the man lost his fingers. They are still calling my name on the beach, though I can't tell if it's to solicit my help or to solicit help for me. The girl coughs, but no water comes up. She's shivering, though her eyes are fierce. I've killed one of the beautiful, deadly Capel Ishka that I love, and I've nearly died, and a fever is racing through my veins. But all I can find to say to the girl is, keep your pony off this beach.
Chapter 16. Puck. I'm still shaking and coughing by the time I get into the yard. Dove spooks at every shadow, her every movement as jerky as a puppet's. Even the sound of the gate closing behind her sends her dashing farther into the paddock, her haunches tucked underneath her. I'm lucky she's not lame. I close my eyes. I'm lucky she's not dead. It only took moments for the stallion to overpower us, and in another moment, I would have been under the water for good. I lean on the gate, waiting for Dove to calm down enough to pick at her hay. She doesn't, until I'm too cold in my wet clothing. Inside, I peel off my layers and replace them with new ones, but I'm still frigid. She could have died. In the kitchen, I eat an entire orange and a piece of bread, slathered with quite a bit of our precious butter. The price of an orange is so dear that normally I would have borrowed one of Mum's techniques for making each fruit go as far as possible. With a few oranges, Mum would make an orange cake, flavour butter, or icing for a treat, and simmer some marmalade with the rest. If we did eat an orange just as an orange, we'd share the sections among us. But I eat the entire thing, and by the time I get to the end of it, I've stopped shivering. My head still thuds dully from where the Capel Ishka's knee hit it. I suck on my index finger to get the last of the orange flavour, but all I taste is salt from the ocean, which makes me even more irritable. My first day on the beach with Dove, and all I have to show for it is sand in every crevice of my skin and a kick in the head. I couldn't even make it one day without being rescued. I keep trying to put Sean Kendrick out of my head, but my mind keeps conjuring up images of his sharp face and the sound of his voice made hoarse by swallowing the sea. And every time I relive the moment, my face flushes hot with embarrassment again. I run a hand over my forehead, which is gritty with salt, and sigh a long, shuddering breath. Keep your pony off this beach. I want to give up. I'm doing all this to win just a few bare weeks with Gabriel on the island. And for what purpose? I haven't seen a hair on his head since I announced I was racing. My plan seems suddenly foolish. So I'm going to make an idiot of myself in front of the entire island, and possibly get myself and Dove killed for a brother who can't be bothered to come home anyway. The idea of throwing in the towel is simultaneously relieving and discomforting. I can't bear the idea of going back to the beach, but I can't even imagine telling Gabe that I changed my mind. It's hard to think that I have enough pride left to damage, but there it is. There's a knock on the door. I don't have any time to make my hair look better. Actually, I don't think there is a way to make it better. It has that greasy, thick feeling of hair bathed in salt water. My heart feels leaden inside me. I can't think of anyone positive who knocks on the door. The door opens, and it's Benjamin Mulvan. I know it's Benjamin Mulvan because there's a signed photo of him on the wall behind the bar at the Black-Eyed Girl. I once asked Dad why it was there, and he said that was because Benjamin Mulvan had given a lot of money to the pub so it could open. But I still didn't see why that was a good reason to have someone's signature on your wall. "Gabriel Connolly here?" Mulvan asks as he comes into the kitchen. I'm left holding the door open. The richest man on Thisbe stands in our house with his arms crossed, his gaze shifting from the cluttered kitchen counter to the collapsed pile of wood and peat by the sitting room fireplace, to the saddle I've perched on the back of Dad's armchair. He wears a V-necked wool sweater and a tie. He's got grey hair and is not good-looking. He smells nice, which I resent. I don't close the door. It seems like closing the door would be like saying that I invited him in, and I didn't. "Not at present," I say.
"Ah," says Mulvan. He's still looking around. "And you're the sister?"
"Kate Connolly," I clarify, with as many bristles as I can manage.
"Yes, I think we should have some tea."
He sits at our table. "Mr. Mulvan," I start sternly.
"Good. You know who I am.
That saves us some trouble.
Now, I wouldn't presume to tell you your business, but it's cold out there and an open door makes a very poor windbreak."
I shut it. I shut my mouth as well. I start to make some tea. I'm equal parts offended and curious.
"What brings you this way?"
I ask. I'm unhappy about how polite I sound. His eyes were on my saddle, but he shifts them to me when I speak. I'm intimidated by them a little. The rest of him looks like a moneyed old man, but his eyes are clever.
"Unpleasant business,"
but he says it pleasantly. "I would have thought that you have people to do your unpleasant business for you," I say, and feel cheeky.
"Sugar or milk?" "Butter, milk and salt, please."
I turn to Mulvan, sure I'll see humour on his face, but there isn't any. I'm not sure, now that I think of it, that it's a face I could imagine humour on. It's more like a face I can imagine on a pound note. I hand him his cup of tea, a salt shaker, and our little butter bowl.
Sitting down with a milk jug opposite, I watch him slice a small piece of butter into his tea, add a healthy dose of salt, and top it all up with milk before stirring it thoroughly. The liquid has a froth on it. It looks like something I saw come out from under a cow once. I don't think that he'll drink it. But he does.
Mulvan braces his fingers on the edge of his teacup.
"Is that your pony outside?"
"Horse," I say. "She's 15 hands."
"You'd get better performance out of her with better food," Mulvan tells me. "Switch her from that poor hay and she'd have more energy. Less of a hay belly."
Of course she'd have more energy on better hay and grain. I'd have more energy if I were eating something besides beans and apple cake too. But we're both going without better for the same reason.
We drink our tea.
I think about Finn coming home right now and finding Mulvan at our kitchen table. I sweep some crumbs into a pyramid behind the butter bowl.
"So, your parents are dead,"
Benjamin Mulvan says. I set my teacup down. "Mr. Mulvan?"
"I know this story already,"
he interrupts me.
"I don't want to talk about that. I want to know what comes after the story. What are you three, it is three, isn't it, doing with yourselves?"
I try to imagine how my parents would handle this situation. They were unfailingly polite and private. I am good at one of those things.
Uncomfortably, I say, "We're getting along. Gabe works at the hotel. Finn and I do odd jobs, paint things for tourists." "Making enough for tea?" Mulvan says,
but his eyes are on the pantry door. I know he saw its lack of contents when I took out the butter bowl.
"We're getting along," I repeat.
Mulvan swallows the last of his tea. How he's managed to drink that concoction so fast and without holding his nose is beyond me, and rests his crossed arms on the table. He leans toward me, so I smell his cologne.
"I am here to evict you."
For a moment, it doesn't mean anything, and then I scramble to my feet. My head pounds like the surf where the water horse struck it. I keep replaying that sentence. He continues,
"No one has made payments on this house for a year, and I wanted to see who lived here. I wanted to see your faces when I told you."
I think, just then, that in an island populated by monsters, he's more monstrous than any. My tongue takes a long time to unstick. I thought the house was paid for. I didn't know.
Gabriel Connolly knew better, and has, for quite a while,
Malvin says. His voice is calm. He's watching my reaction carefully. I cannot believe that I've served him tea. I look at him and smash my lips together. I want to be sure I don't say something I will regret. I am struck, more than anything, by the sense of betrayal, that Gabe knew that we were living in a ticking time bomb and didn't tell us. Finally, I manage. And what is it that you see in my face right now? Is it what you came to see? It comes out like a challenge, but Malvin seems unflustered. He just nods a little.
Yes. Yes, I think so. Now tell me this. What are you and your brothers willing to do to save this house?
There was a problem with dogfighting on the island a few years back. Bored, drunk fishermen raised island dogs to tear each other's faces off. I feel like one of those dogs now. Malvern has thrown me into the pit and is now peering over the side to see what I will do. He wants to see if I will retreat or if there's fight in me. I won't give him the satisfaction of seeing me give up. My future crystallizes suddenly.
Give me 3 weeks, I say.
Malvin doesn't dance around the point.
After the races.
I wonder if he's thinking that it's crazy that a girl like me is riding in the races, and that there's no point waiting until the end of the month, because there will be no money, because I will be dead last or just plain dead. Keep your pony off this beach. I just nod.
You don't stand a chance, Malvin says, but without malice. On that pony. Why her?
Horse, I think.
The Kapil Ishka killed my parents. I'm not going to dishonor them by riding one of the water horses.
Malvin doesn't smile, but his eyebrows lighten, like he's considering it.
That's noble. It's not because no one would give you a chance on one of the Kapil.
I had a chance to be a fifth, I shoot back.
I chose not to.
Malvin considers all this.
There's only real money if you win.
I know, I say.
And you really expect me to put this off on the idea that you and that island pony will cross that line before everyone else?
I look at his silly teacup with his silly tea in it. Wasn't regular tea interesting enough?
Who drank their tea with butter and salt?
Nobody but bored old men who ran their islands like a chess game. I say,
I think you're interested to see what will happen.
And you've already waited 12 months.
Malvin pushes his chair back and stands up. From his pocket, he takes out a piece of paper, unfolds it, and lays it on the table. It's an official document. I recognize his signature at the bottom. My father's too. He says,
I'm not a generous person, Kate Connolly.
I don't answer. We regard each other. He pushes the document across the table with two fingers.
Show that to your older brother. I'll be back to collect it when you're dead.
Chapter 17. Sean. They're all afraid. I sit in a boat, half-turned, watching my charge. The boat has the words black as the sea painted in white on its black hull. Behind it swims Fundamental, a bay colt full of promise and promises, a sport horse colt poised to sell for hundreds on the mainland. One of the colts, I'm sure, Malvern means to tempt George Holly with. Fundamental's coat is turned dark by the water. He snorts out water and breath every few strokes, but shows no sign of tiring. Boat and horse make their slow way across the sheltered cove. The cliffs here are slanted, like a child shoved them over, and they block most of the wind and all of the waves. The sound of the boat's motor slaps back at me. Normally, I would find this ordinary training a bitter drink during race month, but after the strange morning, I'm relieved to have a few moments to sit and let my mind work over events. I still cannot imagine what that girl was thinking. I glance up to the mouth of the cove. One of the new men, Daly, stands watch. With the clatter of the boat's motor and the ripple of Fundamental's breaths, I'm unable to keep an eye out for hunting Kapil Ishka. This cove is easy to protect, however. Its narrow mouth means that one can keep watch while the other trains. Swimming is such a low-impact way to build strength that it's worth the risk. Daly has a shotgun, which won't do much, but he also has a set of lungs, which should give me enough time to get Fundamental out of the water. Daly is from the mainland, and he's young and nervous. I prefer nervous to cocky. He needs to be my eyes, and my eyes would be fixed on that narrow passage into the cove. Fundamental keeps swimming. I was there when he was born, just a collection of knobby joints and massive eyes. He doesn't look at me as he swims. Behind the boat, swimming is his sole purpose. He has enough Kapil Ishka blood in him to lend him a single-mindedness. I have to watch him as closely as Daly watches the entrance to the cove. Fundamental would swim until he sank. Tomorrow, Malvern will want me to assign Mutt a horse. Every year on the third day he asks me to decide, and every year I'm afraid he will ask me to put Mutt on Kor. I cannot bear the thought of it. Fundamental shakes his head, as if to unstick his wet mane from his neck. I lean to make certain that he's not tiring. Exercising in the water is lower impact than on land, but I don't want him exhausted. I was told buyers are coming to look at him tomorrow. I feel disquieted. I'm not certain why. If it's because of the girl interrupting the routine I've followed for years, or if it's because of Mutt's piss in my boots, or if it's because, as we make our way back across the cove, the water level against the cliffs appears slightly wrong to me. Too high, perhaps. The sky is bright and populated with fluffy clouds. If there's to be a storm, it stays away. But I cannot settle.
Kandrek! Kandrek!
My name, a shout made thin by the boat motor. I have seconds to see it. Daly is standing on the small crescent beach by the boat slip, far from the cove's entrance. I don't have time to think about why he's moved. The shout is his. There's a silhouette at the point of the cove where Daly had been. Mutt Malvern. Just watching me. No. Watching a point in the water just before me. A slight drop in the water only 30 feet from us. I know that dip, that unnatural crevice into the sea. It looks like nothing, but it's what happens to the salt water when there's a massive body traveling very fast just under the surface. There's no time to make it to shore. Fundamental kicks his hind legs, his head thrown back, then he goes under. Mutt Malvern stands motionless at the point of the cove. I dive into the water. Chapter 18. Sean. I'm not swimming through water. I'm swimming through blood. It billows around me in great underwater thunderheads as one of my hands finds Fundamental's spine. In my other hand I have a fistful of the holly berries. I've gone years without using them to kill one of the water horses, and now I have them in my palm twice in one day. Fundamental's spine writhes. I feel a strange sucking sensation beneath me as one of his legs cuts through the water under my feet, the current dragging at me. I feel forward along his mane. My lungs feel pressed small in my chest. I can't see, and then I can. Fundamental's eye is wide open, white all around it, but he can't see me. A slick, dark Kapil Ishka holds Fundamental's throat latch in its jaws. Blood floats from a ragged tear like steam. The Ishka horse's legs slice through the salt water, smooth and purposeful. It spares no attention for me. The Kapil Ishka has the colt in a steel grasp, and I, a small, vulnerable stranger in this world, am no threat. I need a breath. I need more than a breath. I need a long gasp and another one and another one. But in front of me I see the Kapil's nostrils, long and thin. The berries are hard and deadly in my hand. I could watch it drown. But next to their two heads, I see the edge of Fundamental's wound. The colt's great, brave heart pumps his life out in time with my hammering pulse. There's no saving him from this. I watched him being born. Fundamental, rare colt, so close to the water horses that he loves the ocean like I do. Colors without any name flicker at the corner of my vision. I have to leave him behind.
Chapter 19. Puck. Finn and I both wait up for Gabe that night. I boil beans. Infernal beans. It feels like that's all we eat. And simmer inside my skin. Planning what I will say to him when he gets here. Finn messes over the windows while I cook. And when I ask him what he's doing, he says something about a storm. Outside the window, the night's darkening sky is clear, except for some high, wispy clouds thin enough to see through, far out at the horizon. There's no sign of foul weather. Who knows why Finn does any of the things he does? I don't even try to talk him out of his fiddling. We wait and wait for Gabe. My sense of betrayal simmering, and then boiling, and then simmering again. It's impossible to be angry for so long. I wish I could tell Finn what it is that's eating me, but I can't tell him about Malvin. It'll just make him start picking at his arms and obsessing over his morning rituals even longer than usual. What do you think? I ask casually, turning the little butter bowl around and around again, so that the owl painted on the side looks at me, and then Finn, and then me again. About selling the Morris. Why are you laughing? He rattles at one of the window panes experimentally. It's not even running! If it was running... I might fix it tomorrow, Finn says vaguely. I think now that he is using the windows as an excuse to stare outside for signs of Gabe. I don't want it to be out there when the storm gets bad. Rain? Yes, sure, I say. Selling it, what do you think? Well... I guess that depends on why we're selling it. To get Dove better food during training. There is an agonizingly long pause before Finn responds. During the pause, he taps his finger all along the edge of a pane of glass before leaning in to peer at the join between glass and wood from an inch away. He seems quite content to finish experimenting with his weatherproofing before continuing the conversation. Finally, he says, Is better food that expensive? Do you see alfalfa growing on this island? It depends, Finn says. I don't know what alfalfa looks like. Like the inside of your dusty head? Yes, it's expensive. It comes from the mainland. I feel slightly bad about snapping at him. It's not his fault that I'm cross. It's Gabe's. I can't believe that I might not get to confront him tonight about Malvin's appearance at the house. I can't stay up for him. I have to be up early tomorrow if I'm going back to the beach again. Finn looks mournful. I feel terrible. Maybe there's something else we can sell, like the useless chickens that spend most of their time dying before we can kill them for dinner. The whole lot of them would buy one bale of hay and not a bite of good grain. Will it make her faster? Finn asks. Racehorses should eat racehorse food. Finn casts a glance toward our dinner. Beans with a lump of bacon donated by Dory Maud. If that's what it takes. He sounds like I've asked him to saw off his left leg. But I know how he feels. He loves Sir Morris like I love Dove. And what will he have left if he doesn't have the car to putter over? Just the windows, and we only have 5 of them in the house. If I win, I tell him, we'll have enough money to buy it back. He still looks glum, so I go on. We'll have enough to buy 2 of them, a car to pull the other car when the engine stops on the first one. Now he has the ghost of a smile. We sit down and eat our beans with a lump of bacon. Without saying anything about it, we eat the rest of the apple cake, not leaving any for Gabe. 2 people at a table meant for 5. I don't see how I'll be able to sleep with this knot of anger inside me. Where is he? I think about that decapitated sheep that Finn and I found on the way to Skarmouth. How are we supposed to know if Gabe's working late, or if he's dead by the side of the road? How is he supposed to know if we're home safely, or dead by the side of the road, for that matter? Finn is the one who says it finally. It's like he's already gone.
Chapter 20. Sean. That night, instead of dreaming, I lie in my bed and stare at the small square of black sky that I can see out of the window of my flat. Though I'm dry now, I feel cold to my bones, as if I've swallowed the sea and it lives inside me. My arms ache. I'm holding up the cliffs. I think of Fundamental swimming so purposefully behind the boat. No, that's not what I think of. I think of Fundamental's head thrown back, the whites of his eyes, the vanishing beneath the water churned to mist around me. Again and again I dive into the water. Again and again it is too dark, too cold, too fast, too late. Again and again I see Mutt Malvern standing on the point of the cove, watching. I haven't heard from Benjamin Malvern yet, but I will. It's just a matter of time. Kendrick! Daly's voice, warning me too late. I can't stay in bed any longer. I roll to my feet. My jacket is still wet and gritty where I hung it over the iron curl of the radiator. Without turning on the light, I find my pants and my wool sweater and make my way down the narrow stairs to the stables. The three light bulbs that have been installed in the main aisle illuminate circles just below them. Everything else is in shadow. The way the sound of my breath disappears makes the darkness feel vast. As the thoroughbreds and the draft horses hear my footsteps down the aisle, they nicker hopefully. After what happened this afternoon, I can't look at them. I watched them all being born, just as I watched Fundamental being born. I can't block out their sounds as I pass, though. They slowly chew hay and stomp their hooves as an itch tickles their legs. Straw whispers against straw. Comfortable horse sounds. I walk past all of them to the stall at the end of the aisle, and there is Cor. Just out of the reach of the light, he is the color of old, dried blood. I lean on the edge of the stall, looking in. Unlike the land horses, Cor doesn't loiter over hay all night or sigh through his lips. Instead, he stands in the center of his stall, utterly still, his ears pricked. There is something in his eyes that the thoroughbreds will never have, something intense and predatory. He looks at me with his left eye and then looks past me, listening. There is no way for him to relax, with the sound of this rising sea, with the smell of horse blood on my hands, with me restless before him. I don't know why Mutt Malvern was in Daly's place, and I don't know how he thinks it will escape his canny father that Mutt was on the point when the Capel Ishka entered the cove. I think of Fundamental again, of his wide, rolling eyes. Mutt was willing to sacrifice him for the possibility that it would hurt me, for the possibility of getting what he wanted. What am I willing to risk for the possibility of getting what I want? Cor, I whisper. Instantly the red stallion's ears turn to me. His eyes are black and mysterious, pieces of the ocean. He's more dangerous every day. We are more dangerous every day. I can't bear the idea that Mutt Malvern would ride him if I left. Mutt thinks Benjamin Malvern will have my job for what happened today. I could just quit instead. I think of the satisfaction of that possibility, of taking the money I've saved and leaving the Malverns and everything they own behind. Cor makes a night noise, a barely audible descending wail. It's the sound of a scream underwater. But from Cor, it's a homing beacon, a confirmation that waits for an answer. I cluck my tongue once, and he immediately falls quiet. Neither of us moves toward the other, but we both ease our weight off one foot at the same time. I sigh, and he sighs as well. I can't go without Cor.
Chapter 21. Puck. Based upon my experience on the beach the day before, I form a new plan. Brave high tide with its possibility of water horses swimming up from the ocean instead of riding later, at low tide, with its certainty of water horses menacing me on the beach. So I set my alarm clock for 5 o'clock and saddle Dove before she's properly awake. Gabe is already gone. I'm not even sure if he came home. I'm a little glad for the treacherous dark slope, because it doesn't let my thoughts linger on what his absence means for us. Once we've gotten to the base of the cliffs, I have to move slowly, trying not to lead Dove into any of the boulders that scatter above the high waterline. What little light there is reflects off Dove's breath, turning it white and solid. It's so dark that I can hear the sea better than I can see it. "Shh, shh," it says, like I'm a fretful child, and it's my mother, though if the sea were my mother, I'd rather have been an orphan. Dove is alert. Her eyes prick to the tide, which is still a bit too high for proper training. When dawn finally arrives good and proper, the sea will grudgingly give up several dozen yards of packed sand for the riders to train on, giving them more room to get away from the ocean. But now, the surf is still wild and close, cramping me to the cliff walls. I don't feel brave. High tide, full dark, under a nearly November sky, the ocean near Thisbe holds so many Kapil Ishka right now. I know that Dove and I are vulnerable on this dark beach. There could be a water horse in the surf right now. My heart's a low throb in my ears. "Shh, shh," says the sea, but I don't believe her. I adjust my stirrups. Dove doesn't take her ears from the surf. I don't mount up. I strain my ears for any sounds of life. There's just the ocean. The sea glints suddenly like a crafty smile. That could be a reflection of a Kapil Ishka's sinuous spine. Dove would know. I have to trust her. Her ears are still pricked. She's watchful but not wary. I kiss her dusty shoulder for luck and mount up. I steer her as far away from the tide as I can. Too far up and the sand gives way to pebbles and rocks, impossible to ride on. Too far down and shh, shh. I warm Dove up in easy, trotted circles. I keep waiting for my body to relax, to forget where I am, but I can't. Every reflection on the water makes me jerk. My body is screaming at me about the threat of that black ocean. I remember the story we're all told as soon as we become teens, of the two teen lovers who met illicitly on the beach, only to be dragged into the waves by a waiting water horse. It was considered a good cautionary tale to all the youth of Skarmouth. That would teach us to kiss. But that story never seemed real, told in a classroom, or related over a counter. Here on the beach, it feels like a promise. But it's no use to think about that. I need to use my time wisely. I try to pretend I'm up in the muddy pasture. For endless minutes, Dove and I exercise like this, trotting one way and then the other, then cantering one way and then the other. I stop between them to listen, to scan the darkness for anything more dark. Dove is calming down, but I can't stop shivering, both because it's cold and because I'm still wound so tight. There's just barely a bit of dawn, far away on the horizon. The others will be here soon. I stop Dove and listen. Nothing but shh, shh. I wait for a long, long moment. Only the ocean. And then I push her into a gallop. Joyfully she springs forward, tail snapping in her thrill. The waves become one long dark blur beside us, and the cliffs transform into a wall of formless grey. Now I can't hear the ocean's shushing, only the pounding of Dove's hooves and the huffing of her breath. My hair escapes from its ponytail and beats my face. Tiny lashes from tiny whips. Dove bucks once, twice, from the sheer excitement of running, and I laugh at her. We pull up short and race back the way we came. I think I see someone standing up at the top of the cliffs, watching us. But when I look again, there's no one. I consider the morning's work. Dove is out of breath, and I am out of breath, and the sea is retreating. The other riders have yet to come down to the beach, and we're already done for the day. This might work. I don't know how fast we were, but right now it doesn't matter. One victory at a time.
Chapter 22. Sean. There's no one on the second floor of the tea room at this time of day. It is only me and a herd of small, cloth-covered tables, each bearing a purple thistle flower in a vase. The room is long and narrow and low-ceilinged. It feels like a pleasant coffin or a suffocating church. Everything glows in slightly rose hues because of the pink lacy curtains in front of the small windows behind me. I am the darkest thing in the room. Evelyn Kerrick, the young daughter of the owner, stands by the table I sit at and asks what I'd like. She doesn't look at me, which is all right, because I don't look at her either. I look at the little printed card on the tablecloth in front of me. There are some French words on the menu. The items in English are long and descriptive. Even if I wanted to order tea, I'm not sure I would recognize it. "I'll wait," I say. She hesitates. Her eyes flicker to me and away again, like a horse uncertain about an unfamiliar object.
"May I take your coat?"
"I'll keep it." Having dried on my radiator overnight, my jacket is crisp with salt water and stained with mud and blood. Every day that I've been on the beach is written on it. Can't imagine her touching it with her small white hands. Evelyn does something complicated and useful-looking with the napkin and saucer on the other side of the table, and then slips back down the narrow stairs. I listen to the creak of her footsteps. Every single step pops and groans. The tall, narrow tea house is one of the oldest buildings in Skarmouth, pressed right against the grocer and post office. I wonder what it was before it sold Petit Pain. Malvern is late for the appointment he has set, an appointment whose timing I was expecting, if not the location. I turn to look out the rose-curtained window at the street below. Already there are a few long-necked tourists down there, here in advance of the festival, and I can hear the drummers practicing a few streets away. In a few days, I think the tables on this level of the tea house will be full, as will the streets. At the end of the festival, the other riders and I will be paraded among the crowd, if I still have my job. I pull up the cuff of my sleeve a little to look at my wrist. The stiff jacket has rubbed my skin raw during the morning's training. There was a fight this morning among the horses, and I had to intervene. I wish Gory would give up trying to sell the piebald mare. She's a bad influence on the others. The stairs pop and growl as someone heavier than Evelyn climbs them. Benjamin Malvern strides across the room and then stands by the table until I rise to greet him. Malvern, who has been moneyed for his whole life, has that air about him of well-cared-for ugliness, like an expensive racehorse with a coarse head. The glossy coat, the bright eye, the bulbous nose over two fleshy lips.
"Sean Kendrick," he says. "How are you?"
"Tolerable," I reply.
"How is the sea?"
This is where he makes a joke to show empathy with me, and where I pretend it is funny to show I appreciate my salary. I smile thinly. "Well, as always."
"Shall we sit?"
I let him sit first, and then follow him. He picks up the menu card, but doesn't read it.
"So you are ready for the festival this weekend?"
The stairs creak again, and it's Evelyn. She sets a cup full of frothy liquid in front of Malvern.
"What'll you have?"
she asks me again. "I'm fine."
"He'll not abuse your hospitality, dear," Malvern tells her. Bring him a cup of tea. I nod to Evelyn. Malvern doesn't seem to notice her going. No sense going without, when there's unpleasant business making it unpleasant enough, Malvern says. He drinks his strange, frothy tea. I am still and silent. You're a man of no words, Sean Kendrick, he says. Outside the window, the practicing Scorpio drummers beat a tripping, ascending beat, firmly at odds with the soft pink world we're in. He leans forward, elbows on the table. I don't think I've told you the story of how I got into horses, have I? I meet his eyes. He goes on. I was young, poor, an islander, but not on this island. I had nothing to my name but my shoes and the bruises on my skin. There was a man who sold horses down the road from us. Royal horses and nags, jumping horses and eating horses. Every month there would be an auction and people would come from farther than you've been in your life to see it. He pauses, only to see if I am sad that my legs have grown into this island already. When he doesn't find what he's looking for, Malvern goes on. He got this one stallion in, golden like Midas touched him. 17, 18 hands tall, mane and tail like a lion's. To see him in the yard was to know what a horse should look like. But there was a problem. No one could back him. He'd thrown 4 men and killed another, and he was eating 4 or 8 bales of hay a day, and no one would touch an unbackable man-killer at that auction. So I told the man that I would break him, and if I did, he'd give me a job, and I'd never be poor again. The horsemonger told me he couldn't promise me that I'd never be poor again, but he'd give me a job as long as he was alive. So I took that golden stallion and I bridled him. I cut a blindfold from a virgin's dress and covered his eyes, and I backed him. We galloped all over the countryside, him blind and me a king. And when I brought him back, he was tame, and I had a job. What do you think of that? I look at Malvern. He tips his foreign tea against his lips. I can smell the butter in it from here. I don't believe you, I say. When Malvern raises an eyebrow, I add, you were never young. And here I was thinking you had no sense of humor, Mr. Kendrick. He pauses as Evelyn sets my cup of tea before me. She offers milk and sugar and I shake my head. Malvern waits until she has gone back down the stairs before he speaks again. Malvern puts a napkin over the top of his teacup, as if it's a corpse instead of an empty cup. My son says you killed one of my horses. Anger touches the top of my mouth, my chest with a hot hand. You look unsurprised, Malvern adds. I'm not surprised, I say. Outside, the Scorpio drummers beat closer, louder, and there is laughter among them. One of the laughs in particular is a low, derisive chuckle, the sort that elicits a frown from those not in on the joke. Malvern's eyebrows draw down over his eyes, and his head is cocked as if he can imagine the scene outside more clearly than my face. The drums now sound quite intentionally like hoofbeats, and I wonder if he is seeing again the golden stallion the size of a barn galloping over the countryside of some alien island. Quinn Daly told me what he saw, Malvern says. He told me how you were exercising fundamental in the cove. He said that you seemed distracted. He said your mind was far from your job and you would have never seen a threat in the water. Of course I had been distracted. That ginger-haired girl and her island pony, and the smears of blood on the sand from the savage mares. I cannot imagine that Malvern will fire me for this. Cannot imagine that he would fire me for anything. But then again, I can. I stand on a knife blade. I meet Malvern's gaze. What else did Quinn Daly tell you? That Matthew told Daly he would relieve him at his post and watch the cove. That the next thing Daly saw was fundamental going under and you diving after him. Malvern folds his hands together on the table before him. But that is not the account my son gave. It's their words against each other. What do you have to say? I set my teeth. This is an unwinnable game. I drag the words out. I cannot speak out against your son. You don't have to, Malvern answers. Your jacket tells me which story is the true one. We're both silent. Finally, Malvern says, I would know your mind. What is it you want out of this life? The question catches me off guard. There may have been a person who I would turn the pockets of my heart out for them to see, but there was never a time when Benjamin Malvern was that person. I can't imagine confessing my wants to Malvern any more than I can imagine him confessing his to me. With his gaze on me, I say, A roof over my head and reins in my hand and the sand beneath me. A slender and abridged truth.
Ah, so you have what you want already, then.
I cannot sit here drinking this tea and tell him that what I want is to be free of him.
It has been a long time since I broke that first stallion, Malvern says. I don't know what it looked like from the outside, this path I took to get to this ruin of an island in the middle of the ocean. I can't compare Matthew's path to see where he might be going.
There are many paths that Mutt Malvern might be on, but I think we both know that none of them ends as the mogul of an internationally famous breeding yard.
Ah, well, have you been at this long enough to know how the horses will go?
Malvern means which of his water horses is the fastest. I knew that the first day. Malvern smiles. It is not a pleasant smile, but its unpleasantness is not directed toward me.
Which, then, is the slowest of them?
The bay mare without white, I say without pause. I haven't named her because she has yet to earn a name. She's flighty and sea-wild. She's not fast because she takes no pleasure in what the rider wants. Malvern asks,
And which is the fastest?
I pause before answering. I know what I say dictates who he puts Mutt on this November. I don't want to answer truthfully, but there is no point lying, as he'll find out eventually. Cor, the red stallion. Malvern says,
And which is the safest?
Idana, the bay with the white blaze. Malvern looks at me then, really looks at me for the first time. He frowns, as if he is seeing me anew, the boy who has spent years growing up above his stable, raising his horses. I look at my teacup. He asks,
Why did you jump into the sea after Fundamental?
He was my charge.
Your charge? But a Malvern horse. My son owned that horse.
Benjamin Malvern pushes his chair back and stands.
Matthew will ride Idana. Turn the other bay loose, unless you think she'll shape up next year.
He looks at me for verification. I shake my head.
Turn her loose, then. And you'll...
He tucks some coins beneath the edge of his teacup.
You'll ride Cor.
Every year I wait and wait for him to say it. Every year when he makes his decision, it eases my heart. But this year, I feel like I'm still waiting.
Chapter 23 Puck. By lunchtime the next day, I'm in poor spirits. When I find Gabe already missing by the time I get up, I decide to take matters into my own hands and go to the Skarmouth Hotel to find him. At the hotel, they tell me he's at the piers, and at the piers, they tell me he's gone out on a boat. And when I ask which boat, they laugh at me and say maybe one that had a drink in the bottom of the glass. Sometimes I hate all men. When I get back, I rant to Finn about how we never talk to Gabe anymore. I talked to him this morning, Finn tells me, before he left, about the fish. I manage to contain my fury, but only barely. Next time you see him, I need to talk to him, I tell Finn. What fish?
What?
Finn answers. He is smiling at a porcelain dog head in a faraway fashion. Never mind, I say. Then I take Dove to the beach for the afternoon high tide, and she's irritable and sluggish, in no mood to work. She's had plenty of days like that in the past, of course, but they've never mattered. Not that it matters today, either. But if she's like this on the day of the race, I might as well not get out of bed. When I get her back to the house, I turn her loose in her paddock and toss a flake of hay over the fence. It's cruddy island grass hay, I know, though I've never cared much until now. I glower at Dove's hay belly and open the door to the house. Finn? He's not here. I hope he's out fixing the stupid Morris. Something on this island ought to work. Finn? I ask again. No reply. Feeling guilty, I go to the biscuit tin on the counter and rattle the coins that we've stashed inside. I count them, then put them back in the biscuit tin. I imagine what Dove might do with better feed. I pull them back out again. I think that this will only buy her a week's worth of better feed and use up all of our money. I put the coins back in. We're going to lose the house anyway unless I do something. I fist my hands and stare at the tin. I'll get Dory Moore to advance me on the teapots. Leaving a few of the coins in the tin, I stuff the rest in my pocket. Without Finn, or the probably still dead Morris here, there's no chance of me getting a ride to Colburn and Hammond, the farmer's supply. So it's out to the lean-to, shoving Dove out of the way to reach Mum's bicycle. I check the tire pressure and teeter off down the road, avoiding potholes. I'm glad that Finn's storm prediction has yet to pass, because Colburn and Hammond's is in Hastaway, all the way past Skarmouth. My shins will be sighing enough from the ride without soaking them in rainwater as well. I pedal off the gravel road and onto the asphalt, glancing behind me to make certain no cars are coming. They rarely are, but since Father Mooneyham got knocked into the ditch by Martin Bird's truck, I'm careful to look. The wind is coming straight across the hills as I pedal. I have to lean against it to keep the bicycle from tipping. Ahead of me, the road winds to avoid the more formidable outcroppings. Dad said that when they first paved the road, it looked like a scar or a zipper, black against the muted browns and green hills around it. But now the asphalt and the painted lines on it have faded so that the road seems like just another part of the crooked, angular landscape. There's patches on the road, too, where craters have opened up in it and been sealed with darker tar. It's like camouflage. At night, it's almost impossible to stay true to it. Behind me, I hear the sound of an engine separate itself from the sound of the wind, and I pull over to the side to let them pass. But instead of passing by, the vehicle stops. It's Thomas Grattan in his big sheep truck, a Bedford, whose headlights and grill make it look like Finn when he's making his frog face. "Puck Connolly," Thomas Grattan, ruddy face as always, says through the open window. He's already opening his door. "Where are you headed on that?" "Hastaway." I can't quite figure how I make it off the bicycle, but the next thing I know, Grattan is lifting it over the side of the truck bed for me and saying, "I'm headed down there myself." I know good fortune when I see it, so I climb in the passenger seat, moving a tin and newspaper and a border collie out of my way before I settle. "Also," Thomas Grattan says, pulling himself into the truck with a groan, as if it takes a bit of doing, "have some biscuits, so I don't eat them all myself." As we drive off down the road, I eat one, and I give one to his dog. I cast a sly look to Thomas Grattan to see if he's noticed, and if he's noticed, if he minds. But he's humming and gripping the steering wheel as if it might get away. I think about him and Peg talking about me, and wonder if I've made a mistake, trapping myself here in the cab with him. For a moment we ride in comparative silence. The truck rattles as if the engine is climbing out of the compartment. So quiet is not exactly the word for it. I'm pleased to see that the cab is cluttered with cough drop wrappers and empty milk bottles and bits of mud-smeared newspapers, made brittle by age. Neatness makes me feel like I have to be on my best behaviour. Clutter is my natural habitat.
"How's that brother of yours?" Gradden asks me.
"Which one?"
"The heroic one, with the cart."
I sigh so deeply that the collie licks my face to cure me. "Oh, Finn."
"He's a dedicated one. Do you think he's up for an apprenticeship?"
An apprenticeship with the butcher would be a very wonderful thing indeed. It pains me to say. He can't stand the sight of blood.
Thomas Grattan laughs. "He's picked the wrong island."
I think, not fondly, about the dead sheep I investigated earlier, and also about Finn, haunting Paulson's bakery. If he could apprentice anywhere, I'm certain it would be there, where he could put salt in his hot cocoa. They'd have to apprentice someone else to pick up the kitchen after him, though.
"Oh, what have we here?"
Thomas Grattan says. It takes me a moment to spot what he does, which is a lone dark figure picking its way parallel to the road. Grattan stops the truck and rolls down his window.
"Sean Kendrick!"
Grattan calls, and I start at that. And it is Sean Kendrick, his shoulders hunched against the cold, dark collar turned up to the wind.
"What are you doing without a horse beneath you?"
Sean doesn't answer right away. His expression doesn't change, but something about his face does, like he's shifting to a different gear.
"Just clearing my thoughts."
Grattan says,
"Where are you clearing them to?"
"I don't know. Hastaway?"
"Well, you can clear your thoughts in the truck. We're headed the same way."
For a moment, I am completely struck by the injustice of this. That I've been offered a ride, and now I have to share it with Sean.
"Keep your pony off this beach."
Kendrick, of all people. And then I see that Kendrick, too, has seen me, and is uncertain about getting into the truck. And that pleases me. I would like to be terrifying. I glower at him. But Grattan's expression must counteract mine, because Sean Kendrick glances back the way he's come and then starts around to the other side of the truck. My side. Grattan opens his door and tells the dog to get in the back, which she does, shooting us all a filthy look. I move into the seat she'd been occupying. Now that I'm sitting right next to Grattan, he smells like the lemon throat lozenges whose wrappers are scattered on the floor. All the while, I'm madly trying to come up with something catchy to say when Sean opens the passenger side door. Something that will at once indicate that I remember what he said to me on the beach, and also carry that I am not impressed or intimidated, and possibly convey the message that I'm more clever than he thinks, as well. Sean Kendrick opens the door. He looks at me. I look at him. This close, he's almost too severe to be handsome. Sharp-edged cheekbones and razor-edged nose and dark eyebrows. His hands are bruised and torn from his time with the Kapil Ishka, like the fishermen on the island. His eyes are permanently narrowed against the sun and the sea. He looks like a wild animal, not a friendly one. I don't say anything. He gets into the truck. When he shuts the door, I am squeezed between Thomas Grattan's great leg, which I imagine is as ruddy as the rest of him, and Sean Kendrick's rigid one. We are shoulder to shoulder due to the size of the cab, and if Grattan is made of flour and potatoes, Sean is made of stone and driftwood, and possibly those prickly anemones that sometimes wash up on shore. I lean away from him. He looks out the window. Grattan hums to himself. From the back of the truck, the border collie whines. The vibration of the truck makes it a broken, intermittent whistle.
"I hear that Matthew is having a bit of an upset over the horse you've picked for him,"
Grattan says pleasantly. Sean Kendrick looks at him sharply.
"And who's saying such things?"
I'm surprised by his voice. For some reason, the way it sounds when he's speaking instead of shouting over the wind. It makes him seem softer. I notice that he smells of hay and horses, and that makes me like him a bit better.
"Oh, he is," Grattan says. Threw a tantrum right in the shop earlier. Says you want him to lose, and you can't stand competition.
Oh, that, Sean replies, dismissively. He looks back out the window. We're passing by one of the pastures that Malvern owns, and there is a splendid spread of brood mare.